Chapter 11 Twisting the tail of a cow will encourage her to move forward, the text declared. If the tail is held up over the back, it serves as a mild restraint. In both cases, the handler should hold the tail close to the base to avoid breaking it, and stand to the side to avoid being kicked. The paragraph was at the top of the fourth from final page of a training manual supplied by the Navajo Nation for training brand inspectors of its Resource Enforcement Agency. Acting Lieutenant Jim Chi read it, put down the manual, and rubbed his eyes. He was not on the payroll of the tribe's REA, but since Captain Largo was forcing him to do its job, he'd borrowed an REA brand inspector manual and was plowing his way through it. He'd covered the legal sections relating to grazing rights, trespass, brand registration, bills of sale, when and how livestock could be moved over the reservation boundary, and disease quarantine rules, and was now into advice about handling livestock without getting hurt. To Chi, who had been kicked by several horses but never by a cow, the advice seemed sound. Besides, it diverted him from the paperwork, vacation schedules, justifications for overtime pay, patrol car mileage reports, and so forth, that was awaiting action on his cluttered desk. He picked up the manual. The ear twitch can be used to divert attention from other parts of the body, the next paragraph began. It should be used with care to avoid damage to the ear cartilage. To make the twitch, fasten a loop of cord or rope around the base of the horns. The rope is then carried around the ear and a half hitch formed. The end of the rope is pulled to apply restraint. Chi studied the adjoining illustration of a sleepy-looking cow wearing an ear twitch. Chi's childhood experience had been with sheep, on which an ear twitch wouldn't be needed. Still, he figured he could make one easily enough. The next paragraph concerned a rope-casting harness with which a person working alone could tie up a mature cow or bull without the risk of strangulation that was involved with usual bulldogging techniques. It looked easy, too, but required a lot of rope. Two pages to go, and he'd be finished with this. Then the telephone rang. The voice on the telephone belonged to Officer Manuelito. "Lieutenant," she said, "I found something I think you should know about."
"Tell me," Chi said.
"Out near Shiprock, that place where the fence posts had been dug out, you remember?"
"I remember."
"Well, the snow is gone now, and you can see where before it snowed, somebody had thrown out a bunch of hay."
"Ah," Chi said.
"Like they wanted to attract the cattle, make them easy to get a rope on, to get them into a chute, into your trailer."
"Manuelito," Chi said, "have you finished interviewing that list of possible witnesses in that shooting business?"
Silence. Finally, "Most of them. Some of them I'm still looking for."
"Do they live out near Shiprock?"
"Well, no, but..."
"Don't say but," Chi said. He shifted his weight in his chair, aware that his back hurt from too much sitting, aware that out in the natural world the sun was bright, the sky a dark blue, the chamisa had turned gold and the snakeweed a brilliant yellow. He sighed. "Manuelito," he said, "have you gone out to talk to the Sam woman about whether she's seen anything suspicious?"
"No, sir," Officer Manuelito said, sounding surprised. "You told me to..."
"Where are you calling from?"
"The Burnham Trading Post," she said. "The people there said they hadn't seen anything at the girl dance, but I think they did."
"Probably," Chi said. "They just didn't want to get the shooter into trouble. So come on in now and buzz me when you get here, and we'll go out and see if Lucy Sam has seen anything interesting."
"Yes, sir," Officer Manuelito said, and she sounded like she thought that was a good idea. It seemed like a good idea to Chi, too.
The tossing hay over the fence business sounded like Zorro's trademark as described by Finch, and that sounded like an opportunity to beat that arrogant bastard at his own game. Officer Manuelito looked better today. Her uniform was tidy, hair black as a raven's wing and neatly combed, and no mud on her face. But she still displayed a slight tendency toward bossiness. "Turn up there," she ordered, pointing to the road that led toward Shiprock, "and I'll show you the hay." She remembered very well the location of the loosened fence posts, but the beauty of the morning had turned him amiable. With Manuelito, he would work on correcting one fault at a time, leaving this one for a rainy day. He turned as ordered, parked when told to park, and followed her over to the fence. With the snow cover now evaporated, it was easy to see that the dirt had been dug away from the posts. It was also easy to see, scattered among the sage, juniper, and rabbit brush, what was left of several bales of alfalfa after the cattle had dined. "Did you tell Del Mariazzi about this?" she asked. Officer Manuelito looked puzzled. "Yazzi?" "Yazzi," Chi said. "The resource enforcement ranger who works out of Shiprock, Mr. Yazzi, is the man responsible for keeping people from stealing cattle." Officer Manuelito looked flustered. "No, sir," she said. "I thought we could sort of stake this place out, keep an eye on it, you know. Whoever's putting out this hay bait will be back, and once he gets the cows used to coming here, he'll rig himself up a sort of chute," Chi said, "and back his trailer in here and drive a few of them on it, and..." Chi paused. Her flustered look had been replaced by the smile of youthful enthusiasm, but now Chi's impatient tone had caused the smile to go away. Acting Lieutenant Chi had intended to tell Officer Manuelito some of what he'd learned in digesting the brand inspector training manual. If they did indeed catch the cattle thief and managed to get a conviction, the absolute maximum penalty for his crime would be a fine not to exceed $100 and a jail term not to exceed 6 months. That's what it said in Section 1356 of Subchapter 6 of Chapter 7 of the Livestock Inspection and Control Manual. Reading that section just after Manuelito's call had fueled Chi's urge to get out of the office and into the sunlight. But why was he venting his bad mood on this rookie cop? Even interrupting her to do it, an inexcusable rudeness for any Navajo. It wasn't her fault, it was Captain Largo's. And besides, Finch had hurt his pride. He wanted to deflate that pompous jerk by catching Finch's Zorro before Finch got him. Manuelito looked like a valuable help in that project. Chi swallowed, cleared his throat. "And then we'd have an easy conviction," he concluded. Officer Manuelito's expression had become unreadable. A hard lady to mislead. "And put a stop to one cow thief," he added, conscious of how lame it sounded. "Well, let's go. Let's see if anyone's at home at the Sam place." The Rural Electrification Administration had run a power line across the empty landscape off in the direction of the Chuska Mountains, which took it within a few miles of the Sam place, and the Navajo Communication Company had followed by linking such inhabited spots as Rattlesnake and Red Rock to the world with its own telephone lines. But the Sam outfit had either been too far off the route to make a connection feasible, or the Sam family had opted to preserve its privacy. Thus the fence posts that lined the dirt track leading to the Sam Hogan were not draped with telephone wire, and thus there had been no way for Jim Chi to warn Ms. Sam of the impending visit. But as he geared down into low to creep over the cattle guard and onto the track leading into the Sam grazing lease, he noticed the old boot hanging on the gate post was right side up. Someone must be home. "I hope someone's here," Officer Manuelito said. "They are," Chi said. He nodded toward the boot. Officer Manuelito frowned, not understanding. "The boot's turned up," Chi said. When you're leaving and nobody's going to be home, you turn the boot upside down, empty, nobody home. That saves your visitor from driving all the way up to the Hogan.
Oh, Manuelito said, I didn't know that. We lived over near Keams Canyon before Ma moved to Red Rock.
She sounded impressed. She became aware that he was showing off and enjoying it. He nodded, said, Yep, you probably had a different signal over there. And thought it would be embarrassing now if nobody was home. The trouble with cattle guard signaling was that people forgot to stop and change the boot. But Lucy Sam's pickup was resting in front of her double-wide mobile home, and Lucy Sam was peering out of the screen door at them. She let the patrol car roll to a stop amid a flock of startled chickens. They waited, giving Ms. Sam the time required to prepare herself for receiving visitors. It also gave Chi time to inspect the place. The mobile home was one of the flimsier models, but it had been placed solidly on a base of concrete blocks to keep the wind from blowing under it. A small satellite dish sat on its roof, helping a row of old tires hold down the aluminum panels as well as bringing in a television signal. Beside this insubstantial residence stood the Sam Hogan, solidly built of sandstone slabs, with its door facing properly eastward. Chi's practiced eyes could tell that it had been built to the specifications prescribed for the people by Changing Woman, their giver of laws. Beyond the Hogan was a hay shed with a plank holding pen for cattle, a windmill with attendant water tank, and on top of the shed a small wind generator, its fan blades spinning in the morning breeze. Down the slope, a rusty and long-deceased Ford F-100 pickup rested on blocks with its wheels missing. Farther down stood an outhouse. Beyond this untidy clutter of rural living, the view stretched away forever. It reminded Chi of a professor he'd had once at the University of New Mexico who had done a research project on how Navajos place their hogans. The answer seemed to Chi glaringly obvious. A Navajo, like a rancher anywhere, would need access to water, to grazing, to a road, and above all, a soul-healing view of, in the words of one of the curing chants, beauty all around you. The Sam family had put beauty first. They had picked the very crest of the high grassy ridge between Red Wash and Little Ship Rock Wash. To the west, the morning sun lit the pink and orange wilderness of erosion that gave the Red Rock community its name. Beyond that, the blue-green mass of the Carrizo Mountains rose. Far to the north, in Colorado, the Roman nose shape of Sleeping Ute Mountain dominated, and west of that was the always changing pattern of lights and shadows that marked the edge of Utah's canyon country. But look eastward, and all of this was overpowered by the dark monolith of the Rock with Wings towering over the rolling grassland. Only 5 or 6 million years old, the geologists said, but in Chi's mythology it had been there since God created time, or, depending on the version one preferred, had flown in fairly recently, carrying the first Navajo clans down from the north. Lucy Sam reappeared at her doorway, the signal that she was ready to receive her visitors. She had started a coffee pot brewing on her propane stove, put on a blouse of dark blue velveteen, and donned her silver and turquoise jewelry in their honor. Now they went through the polite formalities of traditional Navajo greetings, seated themselves beside the Sam table, and waited while Ms. Sam extracted what she called her rustler book from a cabinet stacked with magazines and papers. Chi considered himself fairly adept at guessing the ages of males and fairly poor with females. Ms. Sam, he thought, must be in her late 60s, give or take 5 or 10 years. She did her hair bound up in the traditional style, wore the voluminous long skirt demanded by traditional modesty, and had a television set on a corner table tuned to a morning talk show. It was one of the sleazier ones, a handsome young woman named Ricky something or other, probing into the sexual misconduct, misfortune, hatreds, and misery of a row of retarded-looking guests, to the amusement of the studio audience. But Chi was distracted from this spectacle by what was sharing table space with the television set. It was a telescope, mounted on a short tripod and aimed through the window at the world outside. Chi recognized it as a spotting scope, the sort the marksmanship instructor had peered through on the police recruit firing range to tell him how far he'd missed the bullseye. This one looked like an older, bulkier model, probably an artillery observer's range-finding scope, and probably bought in an army surplus store. Miss Sam had placed her book, a black ledger that looked even older than the scope, on the table. She settled a pair of bifocals on her nose and opened it.
"I haven't seen much since you asked me to be watching," she said to Officer Manuelito. "I mean, I haven't seen much that you'd want to arrest somebody for."
She looked over the bifocals at Chi, grinning.
"Not unless you want to arrest that lady that used to work at the Red Rock Trading Post for fooling with somebody else's husband."
Officer Manuelito was grinning, too. Chi apparently looked blank because Miss Sam pointed past the telescope and out the window.
"Way over there toward Rock with Wings," she explained. "There's a nice little place down there. Live spring there and cottonwood trees. I was sort of looking around through the telescope to see if any trucks were parked anywhere, and I see the lady's little red car just driving up toward the trees. And then in a minute here comes Benny Smiley's pickup truck. And quite a little bit later, the truck comes out over the hill again, and then 4 or 5 minutes, here comes a little red car."
She nodded to Chi, decided he was hopeless, and looked at Manuelito.
"It was about an hour," she added,
which caused Officer Manuelito's smile to widen.
"Benny," she said, "I'll be darned."
"Yes,"
Ms. Sam said.
"I know Benny," Officer Manuelito said. "He used to be my oldest sister's boyfriend. She liked him, but then she found out he was born to the Streams Come Together clan. That's too close to our born-to clan for us."
Miss Sam shook her head, made a disapproving sound, but she was still smiling.
"That lady with the red car," Manuelito said. "I wonder if I know her, too. Is that Mrs.?"
Chi cleared his throat.
"I wonder if you noticed any pickups, anything you could haul a load of hay in, stopped over there on the road past the Rattlesnake pumping station. Probably a day or so before the snow."
He glanced at Officer Manuelito, tried to read her expression, decided she was either slightly abashed for gossiping instead of tending to police business, or irritated because he'd interrupted her. Probably the latter. Miss Sam was thumbing through the ledger, saying,
"Let's see now, wasn't it Monday night it started snowing?"
She thumbed past another page, tapped the paper with a finger.
"Big fifth-wheel truck parked there beside Route 33, dark blue, and the trailer he was pulling was partly red and partly white, like somebody was painting it and didn't get it finished. Had Arizona plates. But that was 8 days before it snowed."
"That sounds like my uncle's truck," Manuelito said. "He lives over there at San Oste."
Miss Sam said she thought it had looked familiar, and no, she hadn't noticed any strange trucks the days just before the storm, but then she'd gone into Farmington to buy groceries and was gone one day. She read off the four other entries she'd made since getting Manuelito's request. One sounded like Dick Finch's truck with its bulky camper. None of the others would mean anything unless and until some sort of pattern developed. Pattern. That made him think of the days he'd worked for Leaphorn. Leaphorn was always looking for patterns. "How did you know it was an Arizona license?" Chi asked. "The telescope?"
"Take a look,"
Miss Sam said and waved at the scope. Chi did, twiddling the adjustment dial. The mountain jumped at him. Huge. He focused on a slab of basalt fringed with mountain oak.
"Wow," Chi said. "Quite a scope."
He turned it, brought in the point where Navajo Route 33 cuts through the Chinese wall of stone that wanders southward from the volcano. A school bus was rolling down the asphalt, heading for Red Rock after taking kids on their 50-mile ride into high school at Shiprock.
"We bought it for him long time ago when he started getting sick,"
Miss Sam said, using the Navajo words that avoided alluding directly to the name of the dead.
"I saw it in that big pawn shop on Railroad Avenue in Gallup. Then he could sit there and watch the world and keep track of his mountain."
She produced a deprecatory chuckle, as if she might think this odd.
"Every day he'd write down what he saw. You know, like which pairs of kestrels were coming back to the same nests, and where the red-tailed hawks were hunting. Which kids were spray-painting stuff on that old water tank down there, or climbing the windmill, that sort of thing."
She sighed, gestured at the talk show.
"Better than this stuff. He loved his mountain. Watching it kept him happy."
"I heard he used to come down to Shiprock, to the police station, and report people trespassing and climbing Tsebitai," she said. "Is that right?"
"He wanted them arrested," she said. "He said it was wrong, those white people climbing a mountain that was sacred. He said if he was younger and had some money, he would go back east and climb up the front of that big cathedral in New York."
Miss Sam laughed.
"See how they liked that."
"What sort of things did he write in the book?" she asked, thinking of Lieutenant Leaphorn and feeling a twinge of excitement. "Could I see it?"
"All sorts of things," she said, and handed it to him. "He was in the Marines, one of the code talkers, and he liked to do things the way they did in the Marines."
The entries were dated with the numbers of day, month, and year, and the first one was 25-7-89. After the date, Hosteen Sam had written in a tiny, neat missionary school hand that he had gone into Farmington that day and bought this book to replace the old one, which was full. The next entry was dated 26-7-89. After that, Sam had written, "Red Tail Hawks Nesting. Sold 2 rams to D. Nez." She closed the book. What was the date Breedlove had vanished? Oh, yes. He handed Miss Sam the ledger. "Do you have an earlier book?"
"2 of them," she said. "He started writing more after he got really sick, had more time then."
She took 2 ledgers down from the top of the cabinet where she stored canned goods and handed them to Chi.
"It was something that kills the nerves. Sometimes he would feel pretty good, but he was getting paralyzed."
"I've heard of it," Manuelito said. "They say there's no cure."
"We had to sing for him," Miss Sam said. "A yay be chai. He got better for a little while."
She found the page with the day of Hal Breedlove's disappearance and scanned the dates that followed. He found crows migrating, news of a coyote family, mention of an oil field service truck, but absolutely nothing to indicate that Breedlove or anyone else had come to climb Hosteen Sam's sacred mountain. Disappointing. Well, anyway, he would think about this. And he'd tell Lieutenant Leaphorn about the book. That thought surprised him. Why tell Leaphorn? The man was a civilian now. It was none of his business. He didn't exactly like Leaphorn, or he hadn't thought he did. Was it respect? The man was smarter than anybody Chi had ever met. Damn sure smarter than acting Lieutenant Jim Chi. And maybe that was why he didn't exactly like him.